Eyes on Whiteness is a podcast that illuminates the insidious and ignorant ways of whiteness, regardless of intent. Our guests are invited to talk about the ways white supremacy and patriarchy are pervasive and ever-present. Our conversations are rooted in a commitment to normalizing the how, not if, lens for looking at the ways it's present for all of us. If you'd like to support us, we'd greatly appreciate it. You can find us on Patreon, Eyes on Whiteness. I'm your host, Maureen Benson, and sometimes I'll be joined by Deidre Barber, who will only show up when she feels like it. The podcast is produced by the brilliant and kind Aaron Rand Freeman. We're excited to welcome you to the show. Weeks ago, when Deidre and I recorded the special election day episode, I realized that one of my greatest fears, should Biden win this election, is that many white people who have been galvanized and developing their consciousness in the last 4 years may feel that it's okay to rest. So with that fear, I wanted to talk to two brilliant women who've been doing a tremendous amount of research and work to look and see about the rise of the white nationalist movement in this country. This episode is for every white person who has any belief in anti-racism, and we need to remember that we have work to do. It means we deepen our engagement with other white folks, practice mindful listening, and hold loving accountability and collectivism over individualism. Christine Saxman and Shelley Touchluck offer great tips today for how to show up to these necessary conversations when our judgment and righteousness demand for someone to be in a different place than they are, but also really dig deep into the organizing and radicalization that's happening in the white nationalist movement in this country. It's a lot closer to us than we may think. Here's the intro for Christine and Shelley. I met Christine Saxman nearly 10 years ago. She's my sister friend, a comrade as another white woman deep in the fight for racial justice. Christine was an educator and racial equity leader in a district near Chicago for 15 years. She has received recognition as an Illinois Golden Apple finalist and teacher of distinction. Christine is a brilliant facilitator holding space for conversations about race, white privilege, and is honored by many national organizations and conferences as a regular facilitator and keynote speaker. Shelley is a white educator and author of two books, Witnessing Whiteness and Living in the Tension, that support white people to develop an anti-racist practice. She co-produces Dialogue Opportunities for White People with Aware LA and is a professor of education at Mount St. Mary's University, Los Angeles. It was an honor to get to meet her today in our conversation and to dig deeply into the profound, scary times that are ahead of us if we don't continue to do our work individually so we can show up collectively, particularly as white people. Enjoy the show. So Christine and Shelley, thank you so much for making time today. I'm really excited to learn more about what y'all have been up to. And, you know, our guests have heard a little bit about what you've been up to in your bio, but would love to invite you all just to share what has brought you to very specifically doing the types of research and presentations and information gathering that you two have been partnering around for a while now.
Shelley, you want to start?
I kind of want you to start because I feel like you brought me into it, and then I'll pick up from there.
Sure. Well, the journey started for me actually in 2015, it more intensely because I was recognizing the ways in which white folks were kind of being surprised by white nationalists and white supremacist groups. And I was like, I don't know how that's possible because I grew up in Eastern Pennsylvania and during the 80s and, you know, organized skinhead groups were a real thing. And so part of me was believing it was kind of a willful ignorance. And then part of me really wanted to be more open and understand. So why don't more white folks look at this? So that's actually where I started. And then in 2016, I had a white student in, I was in the classroom then teaching high school English. And I had a white Jewish boy say after an activity that we did, he's like, "I'm so sick of being made to feel guilty about being white. I can understand why folks would join the alt-right, and I'm Jewish." And I was like, oh. So it became even more of a call to action of like, so what am I doing as a white person who really intentionally works against racism that is making white students feel angry and guilty and ready to join white nationalist groups? And so that's when Shelley and I started talking about doing some workshops. And so we started at the White Privilege Conference and have just kind of continued from there.
And I grew up in Southern California, where now I realize there was plenty of activity going on during that era, but I was not aware of it at all. And really, as a person coming into my own understanding of myself as a white person, that was really focused on my work as an educator with kids of color, mostly Black and Brown in Los Angeles. And so my focus had almost exclusively been on how do I help not only myself, but other ultimately rather left-leaning liberal individuals recognize themselves so we could do better multiracial work together. I figured that my focus needed to be on working with other people just like myself. And that ended up, I think, creating sort of a bubble where I wasn't looking at the far right and anything about it, not seeing it as my role at all. And so it was when Christine started talking to me about what was going on around 2016, 2017, really, and naming, you know, there's stuff going on here we should really be looking at. That coincided with an experience in Santa Monica, which is near to where I am. There's a committee on racial justice that meets, you know, monthly. And it's a multiracial group of people who are trying to do work in the local area. And they hold workshops. And all of a sudden, they were having people show up in very harassing ways. And there were about 2 or 3 months worth of time where Aware LA, White People for Black Lives, the groups that I'm associated with in Los Angeles, had to do some pretty significant mobilization of white anti-racist folks to try to navigate how to keep these folks from disrupting, you know, the meetings. But even more so, it was an insight to me on the tactics of these groups and the ways that they were specifically harassing the folks of color who were going to these meetings and trying to videotape them and use that for fundraising and manipulating flyers. And I felt like a little bit of a crash course. and that was the point where I started looking into and reading and whatnot. And then to Christine's point, we then did a workshop at White Privilege Conference. That was our very first time. And I think it was after that experience where I realized that I still just didn't know enough. I was just scratching the surface. And I think our effort at the time was a little bit of a, how do we have better conversations? You know, how do we have, you know, a rhetoric to counter? And it just realized that just wasn't enough. And so it was, I'd say about 6 months later that it really hit me that I needed to dig in. And I spent about 4 months just reading and watching and learning as much as I could. And that's when I sort of became a hair on fire. This really has to be talked about big. And so we went back to White Privilege Conference the next year. And I think we're much better prepared for the scope of connecting the dots of what's going on out there. And both of us have been doing work on that workshop since.
Yeah. I love too that it seems like all three of us have that in common as white educators, really doing our own internal anti-racism work. And then what are the ways we can collaborate multiracially and particularly support our Black and Brown students? But Christine, I love you sharing that you are, you know, you began into this in a way of realizing, wow, what am I doing that's actually fanning the flames, right? Encouraging white students who are not encouraging, but like the impact, right, of working with a white student who might feel so guilty. And then for you, Shelley, the work of, you know, your own diligence in working with other liberal, progressive white folks that are educators, and then showing up on the defense, right, like to really protect and stand in solidarity. brought you to a place that I think I really love, because you started from the internal and then went to the external. And that I think really makes powerful, a powerful way of being, right? Like to be in right relationship with anti-racism work. So I just really want to appreciate you all for that, because so many times folks go in with the white savior and everything we have to fix is out there. And I just want to lift up that it seems like y'all began and continue to come from a place of starting within so that you can go outward. And I'm really glad it brought you to this place, because, you know, I'm here in the Bay Area. It's a bubble. It wasn't until the last 3 or 4 years that I was really like, whoa, white nationalism is arising. I mean, we had a federal officer that was killed by a white nationalist who infiltrated one of the protests. So that is a newer area of work to be looking into for me. I'm excited to learn from you all. What have you all been discovering? And, you know, when you say connect the dots, help folks connect the dots like me. I am clear that this has been happening, but, you know, so much work on myself and so much work in the movement pushing forward, that's been on the back burner. So help me connect the dots.
Christina, do you want me to do this for a bit?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. So, all of this being new information for me, there's a book that I really appreciated by Vegas Tenold called Everything You Love Will Burn, that really helped me put psychologically a framework together to start pulling all of this disparate stuff together. And basically he talked about there being sort of two different big categories of sort of white nationalist type folks. There's a sort of the boots and the suits. And so the boots are sort of those like on the ground groups that are maybe a little bit more oriented toward violence, a little bit maybe more oriented toward overt racism, and may operate a little bit more in the fight club kind of angle. And then there are the suits, which are groups that try to present themselves in a more, I guess, whitewashed kind of way. I mean, to be perfectly honest, more mainstream. They're trying to be a little bit more politically acceptable. I'm now going to say that that feels almost like old language to me, because that I think was really true like 2 or 3 years ago. At this point, those groups still exist, although some of them are in various states of transition. But now what I think we're seeing is a convergence where what we have are groups who have learned a lot since the Unite the Right rally. These are not stupid individuals. These are extremely tech savvy individuals who also are watching very carefully for how they message themselves. And so there's a lot of their messaging that comes through as non-racialized, and yet the racism is right under the surface. And I say that because there are white nationalist groups who will front as though they are strictly in favor of patriotism. And so their anti-immigrant nature is kind of a block against people seeing their racism. And that there are also sort of the paramilitary groups that may or may not be white nationalists in ideology. And so I'll just cut to where we are right now. And the thing that's been really concerning for me is seeing this convergence between there are white nationalists who have an explicit philosophy that shocked the heck out of me, I'm just going to say, because I had never heard that stuff before. That ideology does not characterize, let's say, all of the people coming out to do pro-Trump support right now. That's not actually accurate. That said, they're there. They're also there along with people who have white supremacist views, which are slightly different in ideology than white nationalists, but ultimately there's racism underneath them, of course. But then the paramilitary militia type groups, these folks may or may not identify at all with white nationalism, white supremacy at all, and yet put them all together in the same zone. And what we have is a confluence where they are mixing and mingling, and therefore, you know, one step away from pulling people in toward them. I would also say that sort of way of looking at it that's been really useful to me is to see sort of the far extremist group, hate group fringe that maybe went under the title of alt-right for a little while. That was sort of positioned as a bit different than the alt-light, which was sort of the more anti-liberal, anti-immigration, anti-feminist, anti-everything, you know, anti-democracy, ultimately, you know, anti-pluralism. But the thing is that right now there is such an overlap of movement that the sort of the what they call the Overton window has sort of emerged. So that's the thing that I think the QAnon folks are neither of all of those things. But again, the Venn diagram is overlapping enough that I guess all of what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of nuance in the details, mm-hmm. Which I think is useful to tease out which groups are which groups. And at the same time, my current fear right now is that they're coming into strong contact with each other and finding themselves on the same side of an ultimate right. effort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The beginnings are the simmering of a civil war, would you say?
There's definitely one group who is actively advocating for that, but there are other groups who do not want that. So mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think to name the Civil War group, so you have the Boogaloo Boys, right? And the fascinating thing about the Boogaloo Boys is there are those who are explicitly white nationalist or white supremacist and or white supremacist. And you have those who are literally just anti-government. Now, they're more than happy, though, to stoke the fires of the white nationalists and the white supremacists, because it's all in service. So they'll stoke the racism while proclaiming not to be racist themselves, because they want that to help further their goal, which is to take down the federal government. Kyle Rittenhouse comes up to mind for me as we're talking about this, because I think this is a really good example of some of the nuance that that Shelley's talking about. So Kyle Rittenhouse sees himself as pro-police. Right. And that he needs to go and help out the police and go to Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's marching alongside a Boogaloo boy who is anti-police. But the Boogaloo boy is like cozying up to Kyle Rittenhouse. Right. And then you also have the militias there who are explicitly white nationalists. So all of them are doing the same thing, which is bringing danger to an already fraught situation that's clearly steeped in anti-blackness. And so even though they may not say I'm racist, they're absolutely gonna foster that anti-blackness and take advantage of the black anti-blackness. So on one hand, I know some folks are gonna listen to this and say, well, they're all in service of white supremacy, so regardless of what they believe. And for those of us who are working within our white community to think about, how do I talk to a Kyle Rittenhouse so hopefully I can prevent that from happening is different than how do I talk to the Boogaloo boy. Mm-hmm. I guess the one other group I want to just give a particular attention to is the Proud Boys, because I think they exemplify what Shelley is talking about. You know, they call themselves like, we're the Western chauvinists. You know, we're not racist. Look, we have a chairman who's a Cuban American. although just recently, just this last week, there was like the coup of an ousted member who said, you know, we're going to take over the Proud Boys and really make it what it is, which is explicitly white nationalists. But that hiding behind, like, we're not racist, we're just, you know, we're just fighting for our ideals, our Western ideals, which is such very kind of veiled language, because then to Shelley's point, it's only one step away from Western to white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, definitely you're illuminating that this is a really nuanced conversation, and I'm excited to dig into the nuance. I also just want to name, I mean, part of the reason that it felt really important to have you all on this week is that post-election, Deidre and I were talking in our Election Day episode, and one of my biggest fears is that folks are now going to feel like they can relax, like Trump is headed out, Biden is in. You know, maybe we still have to do some work because it's a little bit more moderate, but I don't think folks really get the severity of what is on the uprise in this country. And thinking somehow that we have a Democratic party in the White House or that we have Democrats in the White House will give us some sort of protection. So with that, and maybe as a launch into some of the more nuanced conversations, what are you most fearful of as we are going into 2021 as it relates to your research and particularly the who's going into the White House, hopefully. Like I said, I'm still waiting till December 14th and I'll feel a little bit better come Inauguration Day. But in theory, if all goes according to what democracy is supposed to look like, what are the fears you're coming into January of 2021 with?
Well, Maureen, I'm even struck by how you asked that question, because that's precisely the fears that we're aware of and you know, trying to do the not overreact and not underreact. But, and knowing that, you know, when Trump says things like, you know, stand back and stand by, okay, that there are groups who are completely activated by that and are buying into. So to talk about some of the overlap that Shelley said again, like some of the QAnon conspiracies and the idea that it's been stolen, like 100% believe that it's been stolen. And so for those groups who want their chance at power and helping power, they're going to align with Trump. Now, of course, there are lots of white supremacists and white nationalists who hate Trump because they feel like he hasn't done enough. And there's the ones who are anti-government and who are like, oh, this is our moment, right? Like, we can blow up democracy, literally blow up democracy. And so I think about, just as you asked that question, those are the things that I'm afraid of. And I think about a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. And then they found out there's also folks who are planning in Virginia as well, the governor there. And the fact that it got to such lengths of planning and so many people were involved, I think it's like up to 14 people now who've been arrested. Those are the kind of things I think folks really are emboldened to do. And knowing just that the increase of extremism and violence and deaths of extremism has been by white nationalists in our country, I don't think we can expect that trajectory to change.
And for my part, there have been arrests even this week that were not about that government plot, but people either making threats or showing up with guns to, you know, areas in Philadelphia where the counting was taking place and things like that. So the people who are willing to take up arms is real. And, you know, I was just looking today at someone who just got arrested for, you know, figuring out how to help white nationalist and other militia type folks produce ghost guns and turning them into automatic weapons and things like that. And that's actually linked to the case you were talking about, where the Boogaloo Boy shot and killed an officer in Oakland, that's actually a direct link. The person who was arrested. So the fear of actual and real individual specific eruptions of violence is not going away. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And that is a deep fear. I actually sit with a larger one, a more pervasive, I should say, a more pervasive fear around our population's dividedness and how anti-racist invested people respond to this moment. Specifically, I am deeply concerned about the fact that we have somewhere between about 20% of the US population who does not believe that the elections were free and fair. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All of these folks are susceptible to the messages that are anti-democratic. All of these folks are more susceptible to the undermining of civil liberties, undermining of the investment in a pluralistic society. We have Republican figures from the top all the way down who are at various stages of either actively QAnon supporters, actively saying civil war type rhetoric, and or actively recognizing that minority rule is the only way that Republicans are going to stay in power. So regardless of what angle in those folks are taking, again, they put them all into a side. And to the degree that anti-racist folks continue to look at our work as one side versus the other side, make people make a choice, I have a specific fear. And while I understand that, let me be clear. I am on a side. I'm very clearly on a side. I am choosing anti-racism. I am choosing a multiracial pluralistic society that works for the people. Like, that's my position. And my concern is that we are ceding whatever people consider the middle ground. And so there's a lot of rhetoric and narrative that's about to go on, even if Joe Biden takes office. A lot of the narrative we're going to see between now and then in the sort of forensics of the election is about, well, you know, these two sides, it's the two-sided problem. Well, there's the far right, but then there's the far left. And somehow equalizing those two positions, they are not equal positions. One platform is actually about the death and destruction of entire groups of people. And the other platform might be willing to punch people, you know, for the sake of supporting and protecting others as a protective move. So I recognize the sided aspect. And we need a lot more white people who have a strong inner sense of themselves as white people, a strong enough racial identity and standing within their anti-racism to talk to other white peoples who consider themselves in the middle, feeling torn and pulled. Christine, I talk about this all the time. People who say, I'm not racist, but on the left, that in anti-racist circles, that can be a joke. That kind of marks somebody as, oh, well, obviously the next thing you're about to say is racist. And so I'm going to now, you know, in some way, sometimes be hostile toward that person because they're really showing themselves. The trouble is that white nationalists have been very specific and targeted that is their target audience. They are going for people who say, I'm not racist, but. And my newest insight after doing some voter outreach calls in Wisconsin this year is that I believe in Black Lives Matter, but is the new version of that. Because that's what I've started to hear is people who say, basically, I don't see myself as racist at all, but everything in their life has caused them not to understand or feel accepted by or feel invited into the anti-racist movement. Mm-hmm. And if they don't feel invited in, I absolutely know who is inviting them to their party, and it's the far right. And that is my biggest and deepest concern, is that we have a lot of white folks who are really ready and appropriately taking leadership from people of color who are asking people to stand up and be clearer and do all of that work. And that's really important work. And we also need a sizable number of white people who are going to turn the attention to look at white nationalists and the far right and do that work of undermining. And doing that is going to take a more nuanced work with other white people in our communities.
I really appreciate you naming that, because I think one of the ways I believe whiteness is actually playing out is this acquired aversion of cancel culture, right? Like the way in which, you know, if you're on the fence about it, right? Like the wave of, you know, I hate this phrase, but for simplicity's sake, the wave of newly woke white folks that lack the experience and the ability to have these really hard, nuanced conversations that aren't either or, are just writing people off left and right. And so I appreciate you naming, for the sake of the movement, how important it is to engage, to stay deeply connected to, regardless of if at the end of a conversation you haven't like won someone over, because that's actually not anyone else's job except the being themselves. But if someone doesn't feel welcomed, if someone feels like, Christine, like your student, you know, is feeling like guilty or shamed, it does inadvertently drive folks to another side, which I wouldn't have even imagined, like, to name that they're explicitly targeting, you know, white folks who feel marginalized, right? White folks who feel guilt or shame or excluded, for me, really makes me want to level up. Like, I've been watching these Georgia recount, and I've hella family in Georgia, and I was sitting there beating myself up, like, why didn't I get on the phone? Like, I just didn't think it mattered, you know? Why didn't I get on the phone with, and so, you know, and now what, we're thousands of votes away, the two or three people I might have been able to have that conversation to express why it's so important might have made a difference. But you're talking about a whole nother level. It didn't even dawn on me those folks are being targeted and recruited, and that the conversation is so nuanced where they might not be able to recruit them under a white supremacist umbrella, but to bring people in under this belief of, see how government isn't working for us? Don't you want to get on the side of whatever it is, being, you know, anti this kind of government, is really building forces. So, wow, thank you for lifting that up.
And let me say one other thing about that, because I think, I live in and amongst a lot of people who have a deep analysis around the protests and around Black Lives Matter and around the need for the radical voice to push, right? I get all of it. And I want us to keep an eye on the fact that for people who are not already fully there, it is scary, and they need people to make that bridge for them. And without that bridge, the pulling from one extreme to the other, it is why it worked that groups of white nationalists did flyer drops that simply said, it's okay to be white. That's it. That's it. The only message on the piece of paper was, it's okay to be white. Why was that so effective? If we as white anti-racist people can't figure out how to help uninitiated into anti-racism white people understand the what they're playing with and figure out how to navigate a racial identity process that allows them to move into anti-racism with a whole and healthy sense of self, we will continue to lose more white people. And that's my focus, because that's who I am, and I feel obligated to that responsibility to continue to work with other white folks. I don't want to lose them. And this, Christine and I talk about all the time in terms of the racial identity process. We have had two massive uprising situations where white people have come into some level of awareness. And as we know, it comes up and then it may die down. But what happens when it comes up is that people move into a place of disintegration. Wait a minute, what's going on here? How do I understand the world? My world has been shook now. Right now, I have to figure out how my cognition is going to continue to propel me forward in the world. And there's two ways to land on that. Either people land with a more anti-racist understanding of the world, understanding systemic racism, or they can re-entrench into white norms and individualistic thinking and a way that, no, it's really all people of color's fault. It really is about all this nasty rhetoric, and that's just going the wrong side. And here's my fundamental concern on that, is that if we don't have enough white people doing that outreach to help other newly opened up white people move to the side of anti-racism in a way that actually truly invites them in, the reintegration into white norms is far more pernicious and harder to get them out of than it was in the beginning, because they've now looked and they made a decision. Mm-hmm. So we're in a really important time, yeah, where if we can't get enough white folks to do the harder work of facing ourselves, and the facing ourselves is facing our community. And that's the thing that I'll just say, a massive shift in my own psyche happened when I was able to be part of the beginnings of Aware Los Angeles. AwareLA.org totally changed things for me, because as we sat together and recognized what we needed to do, it got really clear that if we couldn't really look at ourselves and accept ourselves for who we are and have a healthy sense of self, we were not going to be able to actually relate to and influence other white people, yeah, because it would be constantly recognized as an attempt to shame or change or blame or whatnot, as opposed to an honest, loving, I see me in you and I see you in me, and let's walk together. And that's the kind of outreach I think we're going to have to, like, put our big kid pants on and do that work, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious what comes up for you, Christine, around what that has meant for you as a white person in being that bridge.
Yeah. As you both know me well, I have always struggled with being kind of righteous in my anti-racism work as a white person. And, you know, I name that as whiteness, you know, eyes on whiteness, the competitiveness that comes up in me. And so I think about the question, you know, that I shared at the opening about my student, and I think about the work that I do now and how intentional I have to be in myself to not allow that righteousness to take over, and to not also recognize that I also was once early in my journey and first realized that racism was really real, and not just in a kind of abstract somewhere else kind of way, but like here. And so, you know, listening to Shelley talk, I definitely took myself down a little bit of that path of, oh God, like I was definitely that, I was going to swear, that jerk.
I can swear. Oh, you can cuss on this podcast. Go on.
I was definitely that asshole who was like, you know, and I recognize it right now the most in the fact that so much of my work this summer has been coaching white folks who've been in anti-racist work for some time, who want to just really be dismissive of like, oh, these white people who just woke up because of George Floyd. I'm like, how do we reframe? Like, I'm glad they woke up. And I want them to stay here with me. And if I'm judgmental and condescending because they just woke up and I woke up, you know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, right? It goes to what Shelley's talking about. And it just creates that further ground for losing a larger collective of white people who are really about dismantling white supremacy. And so I even know now, like 5 years ago, I would have just said dismantling white supremacy in whatever group I was in. And now I'm like, no, like I'm going to like, I even paused when I said it here. Cause I was like, well, I'm not going to say that to someone who just this summer started doing the work. Because they're going to be like dismantling white supremacy. It's that danger of retreat. And I can do it as a white person because I can be in it for the longer haul. I'm not asking any folks of color to do this unless this is what, you know, you want to do. But I want to say to other white people, like we need to really think about what does it mean to meet other white folks where they're at and not just use a hammer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're illustrating so beautifully is one of the tools Deidre and I use with folks is to not practice right or wrong, but to practice asking what's working and not working and for whom with an intersectional lens. And there's a way in which in, you know, kind of coming through a new breakthrough in consciousness and grappling with that, the dissonance of like my whole world being shattered as a white person, that it actually is, right? Like not just Robin DiAngelo's work of fragility, but we are in a really fragile, in that moment of a fragile place in that like liminal space, right? Of like where I get to make a choice, even though it may not feel like a choice, it's a choice. And I'm really watching lots of folks and even, you know, you two sharing your personal examples make people wrong for being where they are at the time that they're in. And what if we actually can practice having a conversation of the ways in which competitive in myself or judgment in myself and making someone wrong actually doesn't work for the movement, which is what you all are talking about, right? It actually doesn't work for the movement, and it centers me, my individual needs to be right. Versus really if I'm as woke as I, you know, my quotation marks, if I'm as woke as I claim to be, then I actually have to be about the movement and not my comfort and not in this moment feeling like one-upping somebody with my level of consciousness. So I really think you all are speaking beautifully to, Christine, I've heard you say so many times, the loving accountability, not only because, you know, in my opinion, on a spiritual and ethical arena, it really feels like the right thing to do. But actually now you all are providing a lot of evidence and have researched a lot of evidence that for the sake of the movement, we are as white folks best positioned to collaborate with and bring other white folks in. And you know, the invitation for us to always decenter our own individual righteousness and judgment for the sake of the movement is a standing invitation. So there's about to be a lot of really interesting Thanksgiving, what we call Thanksgiving conversations that need to happen that I think folks are, you know, particularly with COVID, and a lot of it might be virtual, but it really feels even more important to me that we engage those that we really just want to write off right now in these holiday discussions, in our workplaces. So what advice would you offer folks who are, you know, in that dissonance and really feeling themselves quick to jump back to the white norm of competitive and judgment? What advice would you offer them, and or what has worked for you?
I think about mindful listening and the work of Lei Moonhua, who I had the opportunity to do some training with. That has been good for me, allowing myself to stay present and really listen to a white person's experience. Because I think, I do believe, again, white people working with white people, white folks have to explore those moments, you know, as Shelley said, of disintegration. We actually have to stay present to it and figure out what's happening. And, you know, there were white folks who helped me with it. And, you know, there were some really patient folks of color who stuck with me too. So I think about being able to stay present in those moments and listen to what's going on rather than telling someone how they should feel or what they should think. And that's not always easy, and I'm not always perfect at it. That's my practice. And how do I repair when I don't do that? Like, how do I work to be in just relationship with other white people? And I think my early anti-racism work had me focus a little bit more on being in just relationship with folks of color and then calling out white people.
Yes.
And now I'm shifting to how do I be in just relationship with folks of color as the targets of racism, as the power of white supremacy comes down upon them, and how then do I also be in just relationship with white folks, realizing the white supremacy has also had a toll on us, different toll, but a toll.
I'll add just the power of asking questions. Not going into the conversation with that attitude of I'm going to change your mind, but actually to try and learn why do they believe what they believe, and actually legitimately becoming curious, which is like super hard when all you want to do is run screaming. But I've been particularly influenced, appreciative of the work of David Camp with the Dialogue Company and his specifically the White Ally Toolkit and the model that he offers, which, you know, the race model, it's lovely, but it's basic, but the four key elements I think are really useful as a preparation when we know we're going to be going to that table, right? When we know we're going to be having a conversation with somebody that we are typically at odds with philosophically. Reflect, like, who is this person? You know, what are their values? What are the questions? You know, and then ask questions to get them to draw out their stories of why they believe what they do, why they value what they do. So that's the R, reflect, A, ask, and then C is connect, you know, find some way. And this is where Christine and I are always talking about the both and. There might be a lot that you disagree with what the person is saying, but there might be something underneath it all that you can actually agree with, and agree with that, validate it, connect, make the human to human connection. And then the E is expand. And that's where you have your own story of how you yourself have come to a different place of understanding. But nobody's going to receive that expanding part without the connecting part coming first. Once they feel validated, then they might be actually willing to listen to you. And this isn't a one and done situation, but it's a start if that is a person who may be open to that conversation.
Yeah, I appreciate that. These are rarely one and done conversations, particularly because folks come out of, in and out of ability to be connected, right? You said dismantling white supremacy, Deidre and I say dismantling white supremacy and patriarchy, and we don't unlink them because patriarchy and its domination is so interlinked in white supremacy. And I see that in so many of the conversations, particularly inflamed online, where folks are just dominating and one-upping, and we're not taking the space to really understand and make that connection, and that to give folks time to just, like, we planted a seed, you know, what is it like to consider something, and then to come back to that conversation. If we don't have relationship, none of that's possible. So I deeply appreciate y'all lifting that up too.
Can I add one thing? Because that certainly works when there's, you know, all of what was said. I'm also thinking of what might be happening this year for some people, at least, where someone might have really kind of gone into some dark territory, you know, and you might be hearing some things that just don't make any sense. And I had this one experience not that long ago that was protracted, but a young woman that I know had a really challenging experience in the world. It was right during a time where there's a lot of online information that she began to access that was taking her into the dark corners of the internet. It was absolutely what I consider like infecting her judgment around fears, misplaced fears, and it was taking her from an anti-racist position into a very racist, almost accepting a far right ideology position. And that's not totally uncommon. And that's, I think, it's another thing to uplift. There are a number of examples, many examples of liberal young people who end up going down sort of the YouTube rabbit hole and end up to the far right. Like, how does that trajectory happen, right? And one thing that a lot of the research literature I've been looking at continues to go back to is the staying in non-judgment, but posing questions that allow the person to come to a critical awareness on their own. So I remember conversations with this young woman over a number of months where she would say things, and sometimes the only thing I could say was, I'm not sure that's true. Are you really sure that's true? Boy, that seems like that's coming from some, you know, from something that I don't really understand how that could be true. And I didn't always have all the answers, but I maintained the relationship. And it was about a year plus later that she, and I didn't really realize this was happening to her, for her, but it ended up happening where she said, you know, I was really going toward the far right. And if not for that connection and those questions, I might've really gone further in it. So that's just, it just speaks again to, I think the need to both like protect yourself in relationships and, you know, have your own appropriate boundaries, and to the degree possible to either stay tethered to become that person that someone can reach back out to when they're able to, you know, hear you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for that. That seems really key. I love really just inviting folks to sit in questions. And I loved your example of, you know, I'm not really sure that's true. And then there's an invitation for both of you. Let's dig into that. What's your understanding of true? What's my understanding of true? Can we share information together and can both practice non-judgment? We can't ask folks to do what we're not willing to do ourselves, right? And so I appreciate that example illuminating so many elements of a different way of being, that whiteness would have us do the one and you're done. Whiteness would have us focus on individualism over relationship. Whiteness would have us prove somebody wrong in a conversation, which means now they're going to try to prove me wrong and nobody's listening, right? And so what I appreciate that y'all are sharing is just a very, it's not new, it's a different non-normalized way of being in a white supremacist culture, which is actually rooted in collectivism and relationship and love.
But I think it's been useful for me as I'm preparing for conversations, as a person who constantly is trying to match somebody, I can sometimes forget the very clear ways that quote unquote the other side or you know, is so contradictory, because the very same people who just several months ago were talking about the horrors of cancel culture and spent years with just this diatribe against, you know, people who are against free speech and all of this stuff, had the nerve to do an executive order that says you cannot even say critical race theory. Now, the irony of that, right? I mean, like that to me is one of those, oh, okay. You know, it just feels like sometimes I can forget just how what's the right word? Christine, you help me with this. It's like they're not honest, right? They're not honest dialogues, you know. It's the attempt to you know, just manipulate.
No, I appreciate you naming that too.
But that was the point of like that I, you know, I haven't actually personally felt unsafe, but at the same time, like it hasn't felt appropriate to sit back and look at something nuanced when there was like somebody who was being attacked, right? Because there's constantly mm-hmm. somebody being attacked.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I appreciate
all riled
that.
Up.
I appreciate that distinction. And I think, you know, one of the things in that conversation I've been having with my friend who's a libertarian, who now doesn't identify as a libertarian because the party's gone in such a direction, but the ideology for him is real, is he asked me one time a long time ago, like, why do you care so much? Like, it was almost like it irked him that I kept continuing to lift up the conversation around the oppression of Black folks in this country. And I remember tearing up because I was like, you're talking about my kids. What do you mean? Why do I care so much? You know? And he didn't even have that connection because he doesn't know any folks of color. And so when I say I feel unsafe, I'm less concerned about my own personal safety, but my fucking nervous system is shot because there's hella people I love on the front lines. Like I'm on the front lines and I could put my body between, I was a police commissioner too in Oakland. So I feel hella safe interacting with cops. Mm-hmm. My dad was also, you know, retired police officer, but there are a lot of people I love who've been getting death threats. Right. And so that actually impacts my nervous system. So that's what I mean when I say we've been like the dumpster fire every single day does have an impact if you are connected to people, you know, who you love, whose lives are on the line. That does kick in fight, flight, you know, fawn, freeze. And if we're noticing all of those reactions, how do we get our nervous systems to settle enough so that we can have a nuanced conversation, so that we can take a deep breath and hold mindful listening, you know, for folks who we're in serious disagreement with, who we might even be triggered by because they're reflecting, they're reflecting the actual people who hold a lot of power that are causing me to feel, you know, maybe not personally unsafe, but threatened, the lives of people I love being threatened. So
that resonates strongly.
You know, and I think that is an important distinction because it is really important for folks, particularly those of us with non-targeted identities, to really honor that our nervous systems are fucking trash too, you know? And it feels a little indulgent sometimes for me to say that or to have gotten to a place where, I was okay with that. And also, you know, holding on to Audre Lorde that like, you know, it isn't an act of self-indulgence if it's for the betterment of me being able to show up to the movement, then okay, what do I need to do so that I can show up? And I grapple with that a lot. I grapple with vacillating between guilt and setting a boundary and having some luxury to take care of myself, but trying to have that intersectional integrity of like, no, I need to show up to this in a right way. And that now after this episode has reinvigorated the need for me to engage with white folks that get on my goddamn nerves. So thanks for that, I think.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, Maureen, as you said that, like, I'm thinking about that when we love other people in a way that's not an individualistic love, it's a collective love, and how to find empathy. And I'm saying for me, how do I find empathy for folks who have lost their connection to empathy? And I think about dehumanization and everything that I learned about dehumanization from Toni Morrison and the ways that white people don't look at our dehumanization. But my response to other white people's dehumanization shouldn't be to dehumanize them. So how can I resist that impulse when it comes up in me?
Well, we clearly could spend a lot of time just generating important questions, right? I hope that you all, obviously you have them in your toolkit, but I hope that, you know, folks today are leaving with some of these powerful questions that are not answered quickly and that are not answered definitively. The answer to them one day is a different answer the next day, the next week. And that context really matters. So thank you all again for raising these great questions. This has been, I have to go listen to this 5 more times. you know, we began this podcast thinking about the ways in which we're afraid coming into 2021. And we talked about connecting the dots. And one of the things that we hadn't talked explicitly about yet was the connection, we mentioned it a little bit, was the connection between this movement that was previously called alt-right and the connection, the Venn diagrams among a lot of different groups that are finding commonality and building strength. But the connection to law enforcement is something that sends chills down my spine. And I found a quick clip of a Black man on the street last night in DC talking about what he observed. And I'd like to play it, and then I'd love to get your response based on what you've seen.
When you have a president that's constantly stoking that violence, stoking that hate, they were coming here to hurt people. And, you know, they came armed and ready to do so. And that's the part that actually makes me, you know, makes me mad. I only ever come out, you know, with a camera and a pencil in my ear consistently, you know, because I'm out here, you know, to tell the story of what happens, to stand up for my people, to stand up for the city. So it's clear to me that in the aftermath, with, like I said, what was so disturbing is that the police protected those who just stab people. That's what was most disturbing to me. That when the riot gear came out, when the riot cops came out, they came out to protect the Proud Boys.
Right.
Like, oh, well, let's make sure that the most hateful group is okay. And for a long time, this president and far-right media has been painting people standing up and fighting for justice as hateful people. And I've been trying to let people know that that's not the case, especially not in this city. And this is the result.
Curious what resonates for you, what comes up? I'll just start there.
Yeah, I'm thinking about and kind of ugly both ends, which is the law and order rhetoric that has been so prevalent among conservative groups, which then also links to there are good people on both sides, and that there's an alignment between the idea of order and good has been aligned with those who are against things like protest, right? So this, I'm thinking, and you'll notice I'm like struggling because it's so hard, because I think about, I'm gonna go back to Kyle Rittenhouse again. I live outside of Chicago, for those of you who don't know. So that's like 25 miles from me, Antioch, where he was and he drove over. And I'm thinking about the ways in which backing the blue and backing law and order has set up this extreme polarization that somehow Black Lives Matter are like in their minds. Okay, I'm not talking for me, but in their minds, like, are somehow like they are the ones who are undermining our safety and our goodness. And they can't even hear, the white folks over here, can't even hear that this is about justice and can't even hear critique of the fact that there are connections between law enforcement and some organized white nationalists, and at the very least white nationalist ideology, white supremacist ideology, right? I think about Philly and 72 cops this summer were put on leave, and ultimately like 15 were fired because of like their absolutely horrific social media posts. But then we go back to like the law and order side, but they have freedom of speech. So we can't tell people like what their ideology is outside of work, not seeing that like what's being protested is like, but if you have people who hold these views who are supposed to protect and serve everyone, like they're not. And so that alignment becomes, again, that overlap of folks who would say, I am not racist, and yet I'm gonna support the very racists who are going to do damage in a situation like that. And I'm going to say things like, well, you know, Antifa is absolutely the most dangerous people in the country, because that's what has been said over and over again, and that's what they hear. And that goes to Shelley's simple question of like, I'm not sure that's true. like, how do we find out? But like sitting in that moment, knowing the urgency of lives are going to be lost, like that's the part, that's the hard wrestling. And whew, I don't know if I made any sense right then, but Shelley, save
me. Yeah. And this is not helped by the fact that we are truly living in a society where people are accessing media completely separate and apart from one another. And so what Christine said is absolutely accurate. We have a very solid, not quite half, but a whole lot of our population who is never going to access the information that that amplifies the fact that we have far too many law enforcement officers who are, if not fraternizing, then aligned with and or accepting of, whether they're explicit white nationalists or white nationalists adjacent. I mean, where I live, we just had officers have to get investigated because they were actually wearing 3% patches on their uniform, like a sheriff's department on the uniform. So not all police officers are in that alignment. However, the national rhetoric we are experiencing has unfortunately juxtaposed Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter. And Blue Lives Matter is being supported by Patriot Front and the Proud Boys and all the other militias. And so again, that is where I am most deeply concerned, is that we have so many people for whom that is the going reality, that anything having to do with Black Lives Matter is considered anti-police. And yes, we just finished the summer of let's understand what defund the police actually is talking about, but that has become such a large presence. And I am not blaming that movement, by the way, let's be clear. I think that's an important educational moment and movement for society to grapple with the harm that is caused to people of color and Black people specifically on a regular basis. And I say that as the daughter of a retired police officer. So we had some really interesting conversations this summer about this. But for far too many people, all they're accessing is the hatred of cops. And so when cops go out to do their work, we shouldn't be surprised that it both appears and is probably in some ways true that there are these alignments and unstated supports that we can all see. But I do think it's absolutely dangerous, and I struggle as well to figure out how we're going to actually get through this, except for not ceding the middle ground. I do end this with a question, which is for us in the anti-racist community who really see this as a significant problem and dangerous for everybody. Is it possible for somebody to be a political moderate and be anti-racist? Like, will we accept that that's true? And what does that look like? If we can't imagine what that is, I feel like the polarization and those juxtapositions won't be bridged well enough. And I don't necessarily have an answer for you, but I think it would be really helpful if we found people who were finding that ground and helping to create bridges with them and make sure that they as well align with this movement to try to both hold the humanity of everybody involved. That includes the officers who don't want to be in that position, while we push the systems to change how police operate and what they're asked to do, and maybe help them not get asked to do things that include the more likelihood of harming people of color.
Yeah, I love that question. And I almost think it isn't so much about like in terms of creation of the bridge, it isn't so much about where I stand politically. It's the, can I really dig into how actually complicated this is and how the oversimplification of this is actually the unpatriotic, dangerous inflammation that's happening. And also not digging into the complicated nuance of how we as a society are being manipulated into this division is actually inadvertently being complicit. But how do we engage in the level of being complicit while helping folks navigate the waves of guilt and shame that come up? And it certainly isn't through animosity and isolation. In fact, it does mean bringing folks in closer. Regardless of political, like I'm having really powerful, deep conversations with a person who identifies as libertarian, who is also realizing like, oh, the political ideology I hold is actually only relevant in an ideal state, and we're not in an ideal state. So yes, I as much as I don't want regulations and I am anti-government, who then is actually going to be having some levels of accountability when I see that these systems are designed inherently to oppress Black people, brown people, indigenous folks, Muslim immigrants? But like that had to be a big cognitive shift for him to begin to see that his ideology was only in an ideal state that doesn't actually exist. And so for him to be able to disconnect that was, you know, as you all have pointed out, is a 15-year relationship that I've had with him, where I've just been shipping away, like in the invitation to engage without isolating him. And he still believes that. He still believes in an economic model of hierarchy and a, you know, 1% and all the way down, but is beginning to shift and realize the impact of that. Christine, you look like you were going to say something. Did you want to add something?
I'm just wrestling with, thank you for sharing that example, because I'm thinking about, as you said, accountability, like all these things came flooding to me. Because one of the things that, when I think, to go back to your question about law enforcement, is this accountability question. And it seems like part of the issue is like accountability just keeps being shifted back on those who are being targeted. and so I'm trying to hold on to that complexity of what does it mean to hold accountability, and for those of us who identify as white to meet white folks where they're at and to work to create more movement to an anti-racist stance. And it can be anti-racist stance and I have moderate politics. I can be anti-racist stance and conservative politics, anti-racist stance and have really progressive politics. Like I want to believe that that's possible. But I was just thinking about accountability, like on one level of like with law enforcement and the military right now, there are actually no systems in place to weed out white supremacist or white nationalist ideology. And the House of Representatives actually put in for the Pentagon funding that they should do screening for white nationalism, given all the data. I mean, you can go on, like, I don't have to tell you, cite anything, like go and look of the increase of these groups, the increase in the military. The Military Times did a survey that said like almost 25% of members report hearing white nationalist ideology among their peers. And yet when the House of Representatives put that in just to say like, let's screen it, Senate takes it out so that it can get signed by our president. And at one level, like I do think we have to say in our systems and structures, like, no, like this is not okay. And then how do I also hold space for someone who might be tempted by these ideologies for a number of reasons? So I'm wrestling with that complexity, because I do think there are some spaces where there have to be like, no, you can't have be white nationalist or white nationalist and adjacent and be someone who's supposed to protect and serve everyone. I don't know.
The ugly both and of it all, right? The systems work, the non-negotiable systems work, and one by one human level relationship, because we are individually the collective system.
And back to the point that you started out with about us not thinking that it's all going to be okay once we have a different administration. My reading of that piece that Christine just named is that the Senate modified that language in order to neutralize and not name the white nationalist part, but to add basic toned down language about extremism in general. And I'm not at all sure that was just for this president. I think that was because the Senate in control could not amplify that white nationalists are a real problem. They needed that sort of like that the both-sidedness, you know, even to have anything about extremism, you know, and this is not to argue against what Christine is saying, except just to say, we're not out of this. You know, I mean, we are not out of this. We've got leadership all the way up and down and throughout who continue to tend towards, well, there's this problem, but then there's this problem. So we will try to have it. If you look at, you know, any congressional meeting that they've tried to have where they're looking at far right, it always gets subverted and turned into something else. And so I think we need to pay attention to that too, that is not small. That is not small at all, because although there has been a fair amount of pressure on some of the big tech companies to take some action, it is far less than it needs to be. And that is an area where, you know, mobilization of as many voices as possible to push against not only the tech companies that continue to, you know, allow their algorithms to share. And yeah, that we've seen some news articles where some of the platforms have deplatformed or, you know, stopped some accounts. That's not nearly as much as it needs to be. And the fact that these groups can still create payments through, you know, Amazon or, you know, Facebook, there's still a money support system for all these groups that, I mean, we can be paying attention to. And if our government officials are unwilling to actually call this a problem, then we as the grassroots populace needs to continue to press toward that.
Yes. Brilliant.
What was the dog whistle politics author? I'm blanking right now, Shelley.
Oh, yes. I'm blanking too, but I have
it right. I've shared my blankingness. But I'm thinking about in that book, he specifically names the need to keep naming racism and mm-hmm. and the need. So to go back to your point, so if the powers that be will not name white nationalism, what powers do we need to apply to force them to do it? And that's a fantastic book, Maureen, for folks who are listening to read about connecting the dots, because it does a really nice job of taking rhetoric and language and showing some of the path that now algorithms and to Shelley's point, social media. And I feel like I just need to say, like, we haven't talked about it yet, but like Parler.
tell us more about Parler.
So you may have heard recently conservative folks, leaders, spokespeople saying, you know, these platforms are all liberally biased. So go on to Parler, which is a new social media platform that was in theory, or at least in statement, made to be a place of more civil dialogue. And yet it has been the home of folks who were kicked off other platforms. So Alex Jones, is it Stephen Molyneux? I always forget how to pronounce his name. So like these real clear white supremacist people, white supremacist view supporting people, conspiracy theory, QAnon. And so that like all of those groups that Shelley was talking about overlapping are now going to this new site, which is also being pushed by the GOP as like where we can be free in our speech. And speak truly about conservatism. So like, again, like you're now gonna be one click away, you know, there's a difference between a policy that is conservative that talks about immigration and then flat out straight racist immigration policy. Mm-hmm. And so I think about the need to really think about how something like that's gonna be used to shepherd folks along, who again, I might not believe I'm racist and I might not be racist. And I'm now one click. Oh, and now, oh, wait, that makes sense. Oh, wait, that makes sense. Oh, wait, and now all of a sudden I am.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that the danger to me is how many people don't realize that this is happening. And that to me is what's really frightening, because I mean, when Christine and I first went, I mean, both times when we went to do presentations at White Privilege Conference and said, oh yeah, we're doing this workshop on, so many people, oh yeah, I know all about that. Just because we've read a few articles and just because we even stayed in touch with what's going on with the election cycle doesn't mean we actually know what they're really doing and the way their conveyor belt is moving people into radicalism. There are details that are actually really important to pay attention to, especially if you're a parent, especially if you're an educator of kids, not even just white kids, but knowing what the social media landscape is offering and how this conveyor belt is moving, because that has been one of the scary things over the last year and a half for me, is recognizing how many kids are getting touched and having those touch points even before they enter a school that has a social justice curriculum or an SCL framework or whatever is going on that's helping to uplift diversity issues. They've already got stuff going on that's undermining that. And if teachers and and parents don't know actually how to pose those questions and know what's happening, then I think the typical statement about, oh, well, you know, the young generation's going to save us, very much not true. Very much not true if we don't get a handle on this and help support young people to stand up to their peers and call it out and name it. And that author is Eni Haney Lopez, by the way, Dog Whistle Politics. But that's the thing, that's empowering not only ourselves, but our younger generation to actually push back against these media platforms and know when people are pulling stuff from them. I think that is really important. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for just making sure that we end with that, right? I mean, I think that, you know, coming back to why, as we're coming into 2021, we should stay vigilant, you know, really just recapping that we need to stay connected to those that we might be having our own internal feelings around their, you know, expediency of development. It's even more important to stay connected with folks and help and listen and hold space. To know the landscape, not only of social media and what's happening right now, but also the intentionality of white nationalists and white supremacist groups and finding common threads and ideology and building. As parents and educators, to be clear of how just, we already know the brainwashing of white supremacy is happening as a society, but there's an intentionality in using algorithms and technology for brainwashing our young people. And so as anti-racists, right, there's an extra level of vigilance that we need to inform ourselves about. And, you know, just that this is an ongoing conversation, right? So I would look forward to having y'all back in a bit of time to see how things are progressing under hopefully a new administration. But that really won't be all that new. In fact, because of the insidious nature of the organizing that's happening and because of the alignment of GOP, you know, and the level of political navigation that folks are engaging to stay in office, who then are the policymakers, we need to stay vigilant with them and continue our organizing and understand the nuance of when we're, you know, making arguments about both sides or when we're neutralizing conversations, directly those dots to how it's connecting to the rise of white nationalism and white supremacist groups in this country. So those are a few takeaways I have from hearing you two brilliant women who are doing this work, and I'm really grateful. Is there anything else that you're present to that feels important to just wrap with today that you'd want to leave our listeners with?
No, thanks for having us, Maureen.
That was a tremendous summary. Thank you.
I am grateful to have been listening and really learned a lot today. So thank you both for making time on a Sunday and appreciating you both for the work you're doing both internally so that you can show up in a right relationship to the work we're committed to doing externally. So thank you both so much.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Eyes on Whiteness. We appreciate you listening, and if you're able to support us, don't forget you can find us on Patreon, Eyes on Whiteness. Every little bit helps. Until next time, take care of yourselves and each other, and keep disrupting white supremacy
in yourselves and each other. We got a lot of work to do. Take care, y'all. See you next time.